You know, I really wouldn't know what to do if I needed a lawyer. I wouldn't quite know where to go to find someone who not only knew the law, but also cared about my faith, particularly the free practice of my religion, Christianity. That's why I was really excited when I was reached out to by Nathan McPherson. He is one of the partners at the McPherson Group. They're Lutherans, and they're lawyers, defending freedom and securing the blessings of liberty since 1978. In the past, they've represented two governors, three state senators, CIA operatives, and one major U.S. airline, as well as practiced internationally, with a focus on civil and criminal tax defense law. One California mid-sized business that was alleged to owe $1.3 million only had to pay back $585,000. 45 cents on the dollar. And they said this: thank you to all for your help in this tax matter. Could not have survived this without the McPherson Group. I'm proud to have them want to be sponsors of Rev Fisk Raw, because now I know who to call. The McPherson Group. You can find them at 1-800-BEAT-IRS. That's 1-800-BEAT-IRS, or at beatirs.com. That's BEATIRS. .com, or you can just check my monthly newsletter for the link. The McPherson Group. Did you know that Red Fisk Raw is soon to be available in various forms of ebook transcripts? The first, in fact, is already here. It's the first of the Wolfskatology series, conversation between myself and Pastor Brian Wolfmuller on, well, the end of the world. You can find it on Amazon.com by Googling the search for The Real Last Days, download it to your Kindle, and check out that excellent theology. Did you notice that gold and silver just spiked? Well, that was about a week ago now, but it was a good bump. It went up. Know what went down? The dollar. Because the dollar always goes down. Which is why, when I get a chance, and I'm not risking my money on Bitcoin, I'm actually putting it into gold and silver. And for that, I trust Treasure Island Coins and Precious Metals in Fargo, North Dakota. Fargo, that's far away, you say? They have shipping, I say, as well as a state-of-the-art safe facility for storing your precious metals until you want to come pick them up, if you so desire. You should check them out. Treasure Island Coins and Precious Metals at treasureislandcoins.com. That's treasureislandcoins.com. Yeah, you heard me. It's .com. This week's show is just not going to be as good as it should be. And maybe I've said that before, but it's a lot going on. And you'll probably hear more about it here eventually, because this is, I don't know, a safe place for me. But it's good. I think it's all good. But it just is, it's really crammed down my study time quite a bit. Not doing a lot of writing the last 2 weeks either, which is the biggest bummer for me. But even so, you know, one of the things I want to do here is make sure I go and get all the pieces, that I bring them back to you, that I give you the whole picture of whatever text we just happen to be looking at, so that we can really, really, you know, feel what's going on in John's magnificent revelation that he shares with us. And I'm not going to be able to do that this week, but we're going to try. We're going to go, it's just going to be less than as deep as I'd like to get. So, fair deal? You're still going to listen? Cool. It's going to be shallower. And it just keeps getting deeper, though, right? So we got the seven trumpets. And if you hung with me last time before the American Guns podcast guest thing that I did, last time I was trying to say that these seven trumpets blown by the seven angels, who are in fact the same angels who are the pastors and representatives of the churches in Ephesus, so in that sense, representatives of the church in all places, at all times, holy to God, held in the palms of his hand, right? That these seven trumpets are really kind of two sets that grow out from each other in a bit of a circle, like a ripple. So you have a stone cast into a pool, and this stone is trumpets 1 through 4. But in the middle of trumpets 1 through 4, trumpet 3 stands set apart, and it starts to spread out. And so Trumpet 5 is like Trumpet 3 expanded. And then Trumpet 6 is also like Trumpet 3 expanded, but from a bit of a different direction. And Trumpet 7 does the same thing, but even more so. So that Trumpets 3, 5, 6, and 7 are all sort of the same picture, rippling wider. And then within Trumpets 1 through 4, Trumpets 1, 2, and 4, it's not like they're not included in what comes later, but they're sort of the context for it. Now, to make that point as briefly as I can and summarize from last time, you have a lot of destruction going on, yeah? And in Trumpets 1 through 4, everything in creation more or less experiences this destruction, with the exception being mankind. But then Trumpet 3, dealing with stars in the sky and the heavens, is connected to Trumpet 5 by this particular angel that is part of the falling stars. And Trumpet 5, then, is all about demons and what happens in the realm of the demons. Trumpet 6 is the result of that realm of the demons happening to mankind. So for the first time, this is all like being experienced by men. And then God is involved in this, depending on how you want to, if you want to do an interlude or if you want to connect it. I think it's connected. I think it's the same story. So it's impacted by men, and yet there is God in the midst of men in ways that are unexpected. That's this angel with his feet on the land of the sea, and then his two witnesses, his word. And then, Trumpet 7, you have the whole thing actually in the most clear, historical, connected moment that we get in the entire book. Very, very practically connectable to New Testament times history. The beast out of the sea, the beast out of the earth, the woman and the dragon, the mark of the beast. All that stuff that everybody gets so excited about, right? Because it's all about like at the end of time or whatever. No. It's the story at the heart of the life of the church that's receiving the letter at that time. Now, does that have its own ripple into our own time? Yes. And maybe we'll talk more about that when we get there. But so if you can see then, the three woes, Trumpet 5, 6, and 7, are extensions of Trumpets 1 through 4, particularly this zooming little part at Trumpet 3, the star wormwood that falls to the earth. Now, okay, so that's like the starting point, right? That we got to build off of that. But then each one of these trumpets is like its own little world. And there's a great deal going on in each of them, but it really only makes sense when you see it all piled together. Now, without trying to go through all seven trumpets all at once, right? What I do want to do is lift up some of the distinctions between these first four and kind of try to show their continuity so that there is a third of something destroyed in each of the first four trumpets. By the way, no third in the fifth trumpet about the demons. Yeah, it's all the demons. And then there's a third of men again, and no thirds in dealing with the literal figurative history of Trumpet 7. But this third number comes up. We're going to talk about that a little bit. Try to explain it best I can. It's not the most evident answer in Scripture, if you care about Scripture, interpreting Scripture at least. But before we get there, so Trumpets 1 through 4, there are four-thirds of things. They're not all thirds of the same thing. They're one-third of this, or one-third of that, they're one-third of this, one-third of this, one-third of that. And those four things that are thirded are trees and green grass, that's number one, living creatures in the sea and the sea, that's number two, the springs of water and the fresh water of the earth, that's number three, where wormwood comes down, and then the heavens and the bodies of the heavens. So it's the sun and the moon and the stars, but, well, in the Hebrew mind, that's a bigger deal than just some burning balls of gas far away. It's that too, but it's the heavens. So you got the plant world, so far as we know it. You got salt water. You got fresh water. And you got the sky, right? Space and or the heavens, with this bridging overlap between the heavenly bodies that are planets and stars and the heavenly bodies that are angels and demons. and a third of each of these things is struck and falls down and has a cataclysmic thing happen to it. Why a third? Not easy to answer. I mean, it is easy to answer. You can just think of it this way. This is very simple. The Bible just doesn't tell us this, but it's very clear, right? If I said to you, I'm going to beat you up and take a third of your money. Like, you'd be like, that's kind of a lot, but it could be a lot worse. I mean, it's not so bad. A third's not that much. But, I mean, you know, it's more than a quarter. So, you know, I don't really want to tithe a third, right? I don't really want to tithe 10% these days, you know, but you get the point. Don't really want to tithe a third. It's kind of a lot, but sure better than tithing a half, right? So if I can put this in kind of American terms, a third is a large minority. Yeah? Large minority. It's a lot, but not a majority. So that when this is being used to define things being destroyed, it's destroying a whole lot of stuff, but not so much that it's destroying everything. The good still remains. Now, I think you can kind of get this, although again, the small majority thing, the large minority thing, this is a little bit just reason figuring this out, but it does show up in the book of Zechariah, Chapter 12, and here's where I'm going without nearly enough study this week. I owe you more than this on a normal basis, but it's a fantastic little section. And by the way, here's how little study, how bad it is. It's actually Zechariah 13, as I look at my notes. God says, on that day, there shall be a fountain opened for the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to cleanse them from their uncleanness. Now, this is all coming out of the prophecy that he's going to pour out on the house of David a spirit of grace as they look upon him whom they have pierced. It's great stuff. Again, I'd love to dig deeper into this, but we're going to move forward from that, right? That Jesus dying on the cross is going to clean us. On that day, declares the Lord of hosts, I will cut off the names of the idols from the land so that they shall be remembered no more. And I will remove from the land the prophets and the spirit of uncleanness. Okay, so that's the prophecy is that evil's going to go away. False religion's going to go away. It's going to stop entirely. There will be no more ability to be unclean. Right, and this is such a wonderful hope that when we rise from the dead justified, as we are already justified through faith alone, we'll see the justification enacting upon our bodies and upon all the creation so that we won't even be able to conceive of imperfection the same way we can't conceive of perfection now. Right? We won't even be able to conceive of sin. We won't even know what it was. We'll just remember grace is all that there is. Now, what he's talking about, though, specifically, that's going to come is achieved in Jesus on the cross. This is why he says on that day, and he's talking about the day of the cross, not upon the day in which we see it happen. The greater thing is already achieved. The waiting for it to be seen, that's the minor thing. That's the smaller thing. That's too small a thing to be really excited about. The thing to be really excited about is that you trust in the true God again because of what Jesus has done. On that day, the Lord will cut off, on the day of the cross, the Lord cut off all the idols of the world and all uncleanness. It's all gone in Jesus. None of it remains. He is flesh and blood. He is the eternal God who cannot be created, begotten before all worlds, who is one with his creation as a man. So that, and this is where, if you've heard me talk in the past about my belief that the charismatic gifts, the apostolic gifts, the gifts of prophecy and healing and those things that they've passed away, this is one of those places where it's actually said that that's what's going to happen when Jesus dies. So that after the death of Jesus, verse 3, if anyone again prophesies, his mother and his father who bore him will say to him, you shall not live, for you speak lies in the name of the Lord. Right, as Paul says, prophecy will cease. So now if anyone prophesies, you know, yes, Paul said, do not forbid prophecy. There's a reason for that, because prophecy ceased not in a moment, but in a generation. And so it was indeed there as a gift for that first century by the laying on the hands of the apostles, and that was it. It was over. because false prophecy has been cut off, and true prophecy fully has been revealed and written in the scriptures. There is no more to be revealed. It's all done. It is finished, as Jesus said. So that if anyone prophesies now, and again, I'm convicted of this, they speak lies in the name of the Lord. There's all sorts of experiential reasons. I read about on the internet how this, that, and the other thing. Okay, fine. You read on the internet something. Great. You know the internet can lie too, right? You know, experiences aren't always the most trustworthy things in the world. You know, we are blinded by what we want to believe. So I'm going to stick with just believing there's something here. When God says that on the day that we look on him whom we have pierced, prophecy will cease. So that a father and mother who bore a false prophet would pierce him through. Now, this is just the conviction of not believing him. You're not supposed to kill your children if they grow up and become false Christians, right? That's not what it's saying. On that day, every prophet will be ashamed of the vision when he prophesies. All right, so then you're getting a little bit of the metaphor here too, right? The language is typological. The language is far-flung. It's hyperbole. It's extreme. There aren't any prophets anymore, right? Yet he's calling them prophets. And so I can share a little bit here. Recently, I've been struggling with making a hard decision, and because I am of flesh and blood descended from Adam, I wanted a sign. And if you know anything about me, you know I teach that, you know, don't look for signs. It is a wicked generation that looks for signs. Well, but I'm wicked. And out that little mystic came trotting around trying to find it. I mean, I went so far as to look at the clouds and the sky and say, oh, it's a sunny day. It must be a good day to make this decision. Whoa, what garbage, right? But that just boiled out of my heart. Boiled out of my heart. I was ashamed of my vision as I prophesied, because by faith I knew it was wrong. And so I teach against my own desire in this, right? I will not put on a hairy cloak in order to deceive. But I say, I am no prophet. I'm a worker of the soil, a worker of the harvest field. Now there's a shift then in the text, and I'm not sure really what verse 6 means, so I can't give you much on it today. But Zechariah 13:7 then gets pretty loud. And it's back into the, you know, where's the heart of this whole thing? Well, the heart of this whole thing is not you or I or our prophecies. It's Jesus on the cross, the one who is pierced. So, you know, he shouts, awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man who stands next to me. Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. I will turn my hand against the little ones. Now, we know Jesus himself, our Lord, refers to this verse as the moment that he is going to be pierced. What's interesting, though, so you go back and you look at the context of this, though. What does it say next? In the whole land, declares the Lord, 2/3 shall be cut off and perish, and 1/3 shall be left alive. I will put this third into the fire and refine them as one refines silver and test them as gold is tested. They will call upon my name and I will answer them and I will say, they are my people. And they will say, the Lord is my God. So that's why we're here, right? Because this is really the only place in the Bible that has a real connection to the third idea. True, and during the reign of Ataliah, this crazy daughter that was murdering the heirs of David's line, and they hide Joram, and Jehoiada the priest is dealing with all of this, and then he crowns Joram as king later, and they kill Ataliah and all this. There's a point at which a third of the guards and a third of the guards and a third of the guards, they all go to 3 different gates to make sure that she can't come in with her troops and stuff. We got into that story a while ago, and it's good. I want to tell it again, but I don't want to study it again. But that's like the only other place where you get these thirds other than here. But notice how this one's really similar. So in Revelation 8, you have a third is cut off, a third is cut off, a third is cut off in different ways. Here now you have 2/3 cut off and 1/3 left alive. At the time when the shepherd is struck, at the time when prophecy ends. Isn't it interesting that on the day of Pentecost, those 5,000 who believed were Jews, people of Judaic, Abrahamic descent, coming to faith in the heir to David's line, rightly fulfilled all the prophecies of old. One third left alive, refined as one would refine silver, and tested as one would test gold by the suffering and persecution which they received at the hands of their brethren by blood, for the sake of the faith which they confessed. There is no excuse for violence against people based on race, or even really religion, rightly understood. But it must be seen that the ones who lifted up their hands to strike in racist, religiously zealous hatred in that first century in Judea, it was not the Christians. Those Christians were tested by the fire of that persecution, and they nonetheless were committed to the Lord who saves, the Lord whose name is Jesus, Yeshua, Savior. Struck as a shepherd, and then scattering those sheep through the diaspora of the church, right? And we're getting a little ahead of ourselves here, but the destruction of the temple, the end in the old covenant, and the casting of Christians to the winds. All right, but notice again the third. We're really just here to find out what that third means. The third is a large minority. Whereas two-thirds that are cut off and perish, well, that's a big chunk, huh? I wouldn't even call it a small majority. It's not. It's too much. It's more than you'd ever want to see lost. Two-thirds of your whatever. But that is indeed what happens as a significant majority of the Hebrew peoples cling to the Pharisaic intertestamental traditions, reject their Messiah's pierced hands on their behalf, and too many of them are slaughtered for it by the Romans, as they come and they deal with the zealotry which had ransacked the temple and used it as a fortress for rebellion against their king. Well, certainly, Jewish people survive through that. God bless them. They are with us to this day. God bless them. God grant them faith in their Savior. But as they went away from the temple where the Sadducees held sway, the synagogal tradition of the Pharisees became the common thing that held them all together. And so to this day, they do not have a temple. I mean, they cry at the Wailing Wall. They do not have an Ark of the Covenant. They don't make sacrifices. They can't. Instead, they gather in synagogues and hand down the tradition of the elders, which was at last finally written down, but which is indeed Pharisaism. Two-thirds cut off from the vine, who is the Son of Man. Yeah? Too many. Not something to shout about. We're not happy about this, but it is what it is. Now, compare this to the other side of the equation here, where only one-third of things are being destroyed. Which shows that, I mean, what it really says is that the unbelief of the Hebrew peoples in the first century and ever since, not that all do, you're welcome to, by the way, we'd love to have you trust in your Lord, but the unbelief of the setting themselves against Jesus Christ is a majority problem, right? It's a large problem. It's greater than God normally puts his wrath against anyone. And you got to go all the way back to Deuteronomy and the curses of Deuteronomy for this. And this was part of the covenant. This is why, you know, they shout, you know, we will keep this. And Moses is like, well, the stones testify against you. You know, the covenant of the law was a crucible that destroyed many. Yeah. And the rest of the wrath that we see in history is actually easier, not as heavy. I think that's what we're supposed to take from this, right? That the cutting off of the old covenant was harder than the end of the world in many ways. Now, I might just be spouting funny at that point, but it cannot be denied that these seven trumpets, and they blow, John's pulling this third from somewhere, and he doesn't say two-thirds. The revelation from God to him doesn't say two-thirds. It says one-third. Mercy is triumphing in this preaching. But it is a preaching of wrath. Revelation 8, verse 7. The first angel blew his trumpet, and there followed hail and fire mixed with blood, and these were thrown upon the earth. We talked about that last time, but can you just picture this? You ever heard of thunder snow? It's like a blizzardy snowstorm that's so loud that it thunders. So imagine now, you know, being in that snowstorm, only instead of just snow coming down, around this thundering, crackling noise is hail, right? Big old golf ball or baseball size hail that's not made of water. It's made of blood and is burning with molten magma. It's flying through the air everywhere, right? Thunder, fire, bloody hail. You know, this is awful. And it falls upon the entire earth. Now, what do you think is going to happen when you throw fire on the earth? Well, a third of the earth was burned up. And you got to kind of see a third of the earth as being pretty emphasized here. I mean, I said earlier, trees, saltwater, freshwater, heavens, right? But you could also see it as earth, saltwater, freshwater, heavens. So that to burn up the earth is to burn up everything on the earth, even though it doesn't mention the animals here and it doesn't mention man here. Now, man's going to get his own special place later, but keep this in mind too. So earth, Adam, is the head of creation. Man is tied into this as well. So it's not like we're not a part of that. I hope that makes sense. A third of the earth as opposed to a third of heaven, though. I'm going to lean on that as the main way you should think of this. So strike what I said earlier about trees being the main thing, but you can't ignore the trees. A third of the trees were burned up, and all green grass was burned up. Not a third, all the green grass. Now, I mean, for the most part, you look at the tradition of trying to understand this, the history of trying to make sense of this section of Revelation, and you basically have everybody just pulling something out of their backside and saying, yeah, it's this. And you just have to, like, take it, right? And that's the frustrating thing then about trying to dig into it. You're like, well, okay, that idea might be a really good idea, the way you just explained that. But why is that right? And this, more than maybe any of the rest of it, is doubly difficult here, because trees in the Bible, there's a lot of trees in the Bible, but they're never really characters. With one exception, which has nothing to do, I don't think, with what we're looking at. Although it does have something to do with wrath and fire and blood. Huh, interesting that. But I don't think it has. I don't think this is where John wants us to go. But I'll remind you of it anyway, because it's a pretty cool story. So back in the day when the judges ruled, there was this guy named Gideon. You probably know a bit about him. There's a whole bit with a wet fleece and cutting down a big idol and a bunch of stuff like that, right? He ends up fighting for the Lord as he's told to do, fire in pots and all this kind of stuff. And eventually, Israel has peace, at least from the oppression of the Midianites. And at that time, the people gather around Gideon and they want to make him their king. And he says, no, I won't do it. While this was pretty good of him to do this, to resist putting a crown upon his head, he unfortunately yields to another temptation, which is going to cause some trouble in the future. And this is a temptation which itself, if you're just reading along in English, it's like, what is he doing? It seems that when the Lord had formerly commanded Gideon to build an altar and offer a sacrifice on it, Gideon got it into his head that somehow this was sort of a permanent way to end around and become one with the priesthood. See, Gideon's not a Levite, and the priesthood is well established by the Levitical codes and the Ark of the Covenant at this point. And so you have this really unique thing where he has this altar that God says, build it right now, do this thing right now. Okay, fine, that's fine. But it seemed to have gotten into his blood. And into his mind, into his identity, so that he thought, well, I'm allowed to do this forever. After beating the Ishmaelites, he had received a great deal of gold. 1,700 shekels was like 50 pounds or so. That's a good amount of gold, no matter what era you live in. Verse 27 of Judges 8 says that Gideon made it into an ephod, which sometimes it gets translated as idol, and certainly it seems to be treated as if it's an idol, but what is an ephod? I mean, it's a weird word. It's not really one we use in English. It's a transposition of other languages into English. But an ephod is something that one would wear. It is a garment specifically for the high priest. You might remember that Samuel, when he's being raised by the priests, right, in the tabernacle, they make him a little ephod that he runs around in. He's like this cute little baby priest, right? And that's the kind of idea here. The particular ephod, a shoulder dress of the high priest of Israel, was where this thing called the Urim and the Thurim were, which was the way that they would not really cast lots, but it's kind of like reading the bones. I mean, God himself would speak to them through the way that this little oracle was dealt with. It's really kind of a mysterious bit. I don't know a ton about it. Other than that, it is established by God to ask questions, yes or no questions of God. And so, see, if David's going to go out to war, he'd consult the Urim and the Thurim, right? And of course, all the liberals say, so you're just like all other religions. Well, yeah, there's a few differences, I would say. Even so, it's connected to this ephod idea. And the ephod of the high priest of Israel was worked through with golden threads and precious stones and, again, set onto the shoulder. So when it tells us later in Judges that Gideon has an ephod made for himself out of all of this gold, it doesn't mean he made a statue. It means he made himself a priestly garment. And he kept it in his own city with him, the city of Ophrah. And all Israel went thither, whoring after it. And it became a snare to Gideon and his house. Now, this does not mean that either it was an idol that was set up for everyone to go worship, or even that there was a temple that was set up there. What it means is that by establishing his own form of worship, apart from what had been established at the tabernacle, he led everyone else to think they could worship on their own high places too. Right? Just like the pagans around them. So that the people who lived in Ephraim, now, you pick up on that? These guys come back later. This is Joseph's son, right? Joseph's the great guy who did all the good stuff. If there's a king to come from any line, it ought to be for Joseph, except for that he doesn't have the lineage of Judah. But Ephraim's always going to struggle with this. They're the strongest. They're the best. They're one of the largest tribes. And when the kingdom does rift, and Jeroboam takes it from Rehoboam, well, who's Jeroboam a part of? Ephraim. So that northern Israel, it gets called Israel, but it's really, you know, led by Ephraim. So up in this territory of Ephraim, away from the Ark of the Covenant, you have the establishment of false religion by Gideon. It's crazy. It's crazy that this happened. It's also why, you know, if your name's Gideon, God bless you. I wouldn't make it my namesake if I could help it, unless it's to learn from his great stumbling and seek repentance. The germs of this error don't seem to necessarily destroy his faith, but they destroy the faith of his sons worse than that. It gets his sons all killed. And that's no joke, because he's got 70 sons by many wives. One of these sons, born to him through a concubine who lived at Shechem, was named Abimelech, which is the humble name, father of kings, right? Abraham, father of nations, father of fathers, yeah. Abimelech, father of kings. Not the name you would necessarily give to your son, you would think, if you decided not to be a king, unless somehow in his age, Gideon came to believe that from his line, God would establish a reign. And can you imagine growing up in the house? You think Joseph and his technicolor dream coat was tough. You know, I had a dream. Dad likes me a lot. His brothers all look at him like, who are you, dude? Now your name is Father of Kings, you know? And over there is like Bob and Jim and Goat Herder and Father of Kings sitting on Dad's lap. Now imagine forget the poor little guy. What kind of arrogance might such a one come to see himself as having? Now, Absalom has a similar problem in David's home. So as he grows up, he manifests some sort of qualities that might lead him to continue in having this name. He maybe wasn't even named this right away. I mean, this is kind of important too. The names that we get in the Bible are a little different than the names we have now. People in biblical times had their names changed based on who they were. Now, you do this. We do this in one very specific place. If you get married, ladies, at least you used to be back in the day when you were, believe what the scriptures say about man and woman becoming one flesh. If you get married, you take on a new name. Yeah, your name changes. You're now somebody different. Well, that used to happen with first names. Now we put a name on a birth certificate, and it's like, it's there, right? It's stuck. Yeah. It wasn't always like that. That's why we have nicknames, though. So imagine the Bible just takes nicknames to be at the same level as your given name. So it's possible that Abimelech is really named this later in life, when dad's like, yep, from this guy's going to be something. Watch, he's got ambition. Yeah. I'm going to call you Father of Kings, even though your name used to be, picks his nose kind of stuff. Well, that all seems fine and good until Gideon dies. And Israel at this point is again falling into Baal worship. And it's rooted in Gideon's own city. Yeah? Which is kind of crazy, but remember, he's already shown them that you don't have to go to the Ark of the Covenant to find God. So why would they not just do it wherever with whoever? So they start worshiping this guy named Baal-berith. Or the covenant Baal. And all these, the Baals were like, it was like his own mini pantheon all under the one big one. And they're all kind of the same and they're all kind of different. But it's like they worshipped Baal as a god in covenant or a god with whom they made a covenant. And so it was like his specialized and edged to him. And this worship of Baal-berith was performed at Shechem in an imitation of Yahweh worship. Which is, this is always the problem with the North. It's really all of Israel, but Ephraim especially. It never just goes and worships Baal straight up. Like, let's go become Assyrians and worship Moloch. It always just takes all the Baal stuff and then puts Yahweh's name on and around it. Or it takes all the Yahweh stuff and it puts Baal's name on and around it. This is why instituting new forms of worship or even blending them with other forms of worship is it's an old school, not such a good idea practice. That being said, the people of Shechem are worshiping this Baal-berith guy in place of Jehovah, even though Gideon the Baal fighter, Jerubbaal as his name was, had saved them from the punishments of this very thing. Well, so he dies, and then Abimelech, this bastard son, sees a path. Remember, he's being called Abimelech. Well, I see a path to being my namesake. And he plans to make sure there are no other claimants to his father's sort of priestly throne. Abimelech goes to Shechem, to where his mother was from, yeah, and he gets that entire region, which is like it's his extended family, to join with him to set a trap for his 69 brothers. And he does so by mocking his own dad. What is better for you? That 70 men rule you? All those sons of the Baal fighter? Or one man who is also your own flesh and blood? Now, interesting, notice the lie. He kind of goes in and he says, look, all these other guys, they're going to try to use my dad's name against you and rule over you. But why would you want that? But here I am, a member of your own tribe. Let's get rid of those guys, and I'll be good to you. It's pretty clever. It's pretty evil. And it works. The people of his mother's line give their heart to Abimelech. They follow him. The crowd is stirred up by him, and they give him 70 shekels of silver from the house of Baal of Covenants, from the treasury there. And with that money, Abimelech goes and he hires what are called desperate men, right? This is just to say mercenaries, warriors for hire. And with their help, he goes upon his brothers at Ophrah, and they're all slaughtered. Now, we don't know much about the, is it a surprise? How's it work? He's got mercenaries. They don't. He's planning to have a kingdom. They aren't. They're living as shepherds, yeah? And he kills all of them except one. Except one. Was he hiding in the baggage? Was he out with dad's sheep? I don't know, yeah? His name's Jotham, and he hid himself. So they get everybody except for him. Now, it seems they don't really even know they've missed him at this point. All the citizens of Shechem come out to meet Abimelech and his little army he's got together. and to make him king. The house of Millo is there as well, at the memorial Terebinth at Shechem. There's a good chance that Millo is just referring to a citadel or a castle and the people who lived in it there at Shechem. Some sort of rampart made by having two walls with the middle kind of filled up with rubbish to create a barrier. They all come out from that castle, that fortress, whatever it is, the stronghold that's there, and they gather at this memorial Terebinth. It's just a tree, right? Remember, the worship of the Baals and the worship of the high places also involves the worship of, did you catch it? Trees. Trees of life, yes. The world tree, Yggdrasil, the belief that somehow there's a spiritual ascent through the power of the tree, the circle and the pole, all these things tied together. If you ever saw Avatar, when they're all praying with their little USB tails linked together under the tree at the end of the thing, that's the idea. That's the high places right there. That's paganism at its core. It's not just Israelite area paganism. It's world paganism. Trees always are part of this. They come out to this oak tree where there's a stone that's probably set up there, and they make him king. Now, what's interesting also is that this is the very same spot where Joshua had stood a couple generations before, renewing the covenant of Israel with the Lord on their way into the land. And here they are, here they stand, breaking the entire thing, making a father of kings to complete their covenant with the Baals. Now, Jotham, who had escaped, it doesn't just run away and hide. I mean, he's going to go hide, but first, he knows what's going on, and he gets up on a mountain top. I don't know how this happened, because I haven't seen the land, but I can imagine it this way, that Shechem has this Mount Gerizim that's near it, and there must be some sort of cliff hang or outreach, outcrops, or he could get up above where they were gathering by this tree, 800 feet above the valley of Shechem. Yeah, so his voice is going to travel down 800 feet. What is that? 3 football fields? I mean, it's a long way. I don't know quite how this all works out. But he gets up there and he starts to shout down into the midst of their assembly, into the midst of their party. As they sit around worshiping their tree, he tells a parable about trees. He says, "Listen to me, all you people of Shechem, for God is in our hearing. The trees gathered one day to find for themselves a king. They looked to the olive, to the fig, to the vine. But all of them said, 'You know, it's a lot of work. I got better stuff to do, frankly. I would rather be doing what I do most naturally, what I'm made to do. So, no, I will not rule over you.' But then the briar, the thorn bush, kind of walked in and said, 'Whoa, whoa, whoa. Before y'all go, I'll be king.' And so they make him king." Now, so far, it's pretty straight up. What we're dealing with is worthwhile things. The worthwhile ones are able to say, "We have a job to do that is not to be your king." This is the 69 sons of Gideon, by the way, right? Who were just fine with their syncretized half-Yahweh religion, but certainly didn't need the power for themselves. But again, now it's become that, right? That this new priesthood has been a temptation to one among them. And he is not worthwhile. He is not as valuable as a vine which bears fruit, or a fig tree which bears figs, or an oil tree which brings forth wine. The briar, on the other hand, has nothing. Nothing but thorns. It's not even sufficient to cast a shadow, even though that's what it says. It says, "I'll be your king. You can rest in my shade." It can't even do what it says it's going to do. But then Jotham, he turns a little bit, and it's kind of tough. It's a twist in the text where it says, "And if not," which right on the edge of that shadow part, you know, "trust in my shadow, but not so much gonna happen," is kind of the way you got to hear that. "But not so much shade, rather fire." fire will go out from this briar and consume even the cedars of Lebanon. And these are like the big trees. These are the redwoods, right? They're not redwoods, but they're big. They're big and they're healthy and they're strong, noble. But fire kindles in the thorns and ravages the entire land. Clearly, the meaning of the parable is that this one worthless man is going to bring about quite a bit of trouble for everybody else. And the rest of the story does kind of play out this prophecy. Was Jotham a prophet? I don't know. But clearly what happens here is akin to prophecy, and it is fulfilled. Jotham flees to another town, and Abimelech just goes ahead and reigns as king for about 3 years. But God sends a punishment. He sends an evil spirit between him and the people of Shechem so that they start to plot and plan against each other. And this is similar to when an evil spirit is sent by God to plague Saul, right? He makes use of the demons. He lets or allows them to go so far so that he can achieve his purpose, which is merciful and just and good. And this evil spirit is sent to punish their false religion. You know, what they brought, this snare, which again Gideon kind of put in place. So we don't know exactly why the people get sick of Abimelech. I mean, clearly the evil spirit has something to do with it, but what's their excuse? What's their justification? We don't exactly know why, but they decide to hire some of their own mercenaries, some liars in wait, who they place at the tops of the mountains, Ebal and Gerizim, between which Shechem is situated. And why would they do this? Is it to try to capture him as he goes somewhere? Is it to discredit his ability to run the government by having too many thieves kind of in the region? Well, Abimelech discovers that this is, whichever way, that this is being done by some of the people in the town. And he prepares to put down the robbers, the brigands, with some of his own troops. But then open rebellion just kind of happens around him. A guy named Gaal, the son of Ebed, has come to Shechem with his brothers. And it seems he was some kind of traveling warrior, right? A brigand, a mercenary, but one who people might have known. And he went about in a company of freebooters, trying to, you know, get people to pay him to do what he was good at, you know, use his sword. And he's welcomed in Shechem because they're dissatisfied with Abimelech. And so he starts to boast in the midst of them about how he probably could do a better job. And so they bring out some of the holy grape juice. Oh, wait. Holy wine. Juice made from grapes that they consider holy as part of their Baal worship. And they're all getting drunk together, having a little conversation about what they're going to do. And at this feast, Gaal calls upon them to revolt. He says, "Who is this Abimelech? Who is Shechem that we would serve him?" Now, he's not saying, like, who is Shechem? He's nobody. He's saying, why would Shechem serve this who-is-he-nobody Abimelech? Is not Abimelech the son of Jerubbaal, the Baal slayer? And isn't this guy Zebul over here? You're his officer? Why would you submit to him? Serve the men of Hamor, who is the father of Shechem. So in short, Gaal thinks Abimelech is contemptible and says as much and calls on the people of Shechem as the sons of Hamor to revolt and follow one of their true sons. And by the way, just because it's fun, I mean, Hamor, this is the name of the Hivite prince who had founded the city of Shechem long before. So the men of Hamor are like going back past whatever Jewish roots kind of got connected here through Ephraim to the old Hivites, which, remember, if you don't kill them all, you interbreed with them, what happens? You pick up their religion and their blood, right? So he's appealing to all of that. Now, whether or not Gaal is actually one of them, I don't know, but he certainly identifies himself with them when he says, "Why should we serve him? Oh, that this people were in my hand and I would remove Abimelech." And of course, remember, he's drunk. He's boasting really loud. Now, what about this guy Zebul? Zebul's there and he sees this uprising take place. He is one of them. He's a Shechemite. So whose side is he going to be on? Is he going to go with Gaal or is he going to go with Abimelech? Well, the text tells us that he does go and report it to Abimelech, but there's also a bit of a trap that's set by this report. So maybe this is, you know, he's a double agent. He's waiting to see how this whole thing plays out. He tells Abimelech what's taking place. He tells him about the speech. And he tells him he should come near to the town and hide. And then after this, he would convince Gaal and his followers to come out, and they could just fight it out in the field. Now, again, is it whose side is he on? Probably on Abimelech's, but maybe it's sort of he's just waiting to see. You know, let these guys fight it out. We'll figure it out after that. Well, Abimelech does. He rises up during the night with the people that are with him, the troops that he had with him. And he goes and he lies in wait. And the morning, Gaal comes out. And remember, he was drunk before this, so he may not be feeling so good. But he comes out and he stands before the city gate, and Abimelech rises up with his whole army in ambush, and kaboom, there's a fight. Now, Gaal, he turns to Zebul, who's back with him again, and says, "Now, look, they're here. How'd they get here? Oh, yeah, right. Maybe I sent you there. Should I fight them?" It's kind of the question. Zebul's like, "Yeah, man, you got this. Those aren't people. Those are shadows. You got this." And Gaal's like, I don't know. That looks like a lot of guys. And they're coming down from over in that area by the wizard's oaks and all that. That's a dangerous place. And Zebul goes, "Where's your mouth now? You who would ask, who is Abimelech? Where's your mouth now? Go fight him." And Gaal does. He goes out, and before all the citizens of Shechem, not as their leader, right, but only with his own men. So sort of a mano-a-mano thing here. He goes out to fight. They go out to fight. It does not fall well. His men are all killed even as they run back to the gate, and they're slain even as they're trying to get it back into the city. Now, Abimelech, he doesn't force his way into the city, but he does remain there. Because remember, he knows all this is being done by them, yeah? And so the next day, when they go out just to work the fields, Abimelech falls upon them in three different companies. Oop, thirds. Oh, catch that. And he slays them in the field. He takes the city. All the people that are in, he destroys it. He burns it to the ground and he throws salt on it, right? So you can't ever live there again. He just destroys the ground, a symbolical act signifying the city was turned into a barren desert, which it was. Now, some of the people, though, they fled into that castle, right? Into that fortress of Millo there. But see, it had a roof that could be set on fire. And so Abimelech goes and he cuts down a bunch of... Wait, what? Trees? Yeah, he does. He cuts down a bunch of trees, lays them on his shoulders, all his men's shoulders, the branches. They bring them back. They put them on fire, and they hoist them up onto the roof. So the people within this tower of Shechem, which is about 1,000 people, perish under the flames as from the briar the thorn goes out into the trees. Yeah? Yeah? Catch all that? But wait, there's more. Because Abimelech doesn't escape this fire himself. He goes on from Shechem to Thebes, I'm not sure. He besieges that town and takes it. But during the fight, coming up to its own strong tower in which men and women and other inhabitants had taken refuge, as he tries to advance to set the door on fire, a woman throws a millstone. You remember this. She throws a millstone down on the from the roof, smashes his skull, whereby... he calls hastily to those who are with him to give him a death blow because it didn't kill him. Right? He's there with a smashed skull. His brain is seeping out. He's still alive. Somebody kill me so no one may say a woman slew the father of kings. After his death, his army just kind of dissipates. They run off. And the historian who wrote the Judges closes by reminding us that in this manner, God recompensed Abimelech and the citizens of Shechem. Now, I don't know if that has anything to do with Revelation chapter 8. I really don't. But it's the only place where the trees really, really stand apart in the Old Testament. I know there's other places where there are trees. I mean, the high places, like I was saying, that the oaks and all that kind of stuff. And certainly, I mean, the cedars of Lebanon, they're a big part of all sorts of prophecies of value and good and this kind of stuff. And then you have this issue in the New Testament that Jesus Christ himself is pierced and hanged on a tree. I'm just not sure that has anything to do with Revelation 8. I told you it wasn't going to be a great show. I'm frustrated that I don't have a better answer for this. Hail, fire, and blood fall upon the earth, and the earth is ruined so that nothing grows. And see, this is the fire and the salt that Abimelech was doing. This is why the wrath of God is always a fiery plague. This is why Jesus drinks the cup of his baptism of fire on the tree, pierced and nailed to it, because when fire comes down from heaven, nothing gets to live anymore. But see, this is where Revelation 8 7 is good news. It's only a third of the earth that's burned. It's only a third of the trees that are burned. It's all the green grass. It's also only the start of this war against Gog from Magog, which I teased you with a little while ago, and I still haven't gotten to it. So my hope we'll get there. I mean, what does Gog ever do to you? Why would all this happen to him? And we'll come back to that. If nothing else, you know, this I shouldn't apologize for my own podcast. I mean, if you're listening this long, you must enjoy it a little bit, but man, it doesn't feel as good as it could be. If nothing else, it's a pit stop in this rippled cycle of trumpets. Four for the entire creation, four for the entire world, one third of everything that is, and then the three woes of what it means for demons, for men, and for history. Take that part home. We'll pick up there next time.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes, and check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.